Hi everyone, I'm your host NG and welcome to the 50th, yes 50th, episode of the podcast. Sounds about right? Audiobooks help us understand the world. And on this episode, I was joined by Bruce Schneier, author of the book A Hacker's Mind, How the Powerful Bend Society's Rules and How to Bend Them Back. And it's not just computers, hacking is everywhere. A hack is any means of subverting a system's rules in unintended ways. The tax code isn't computer code, but a series of complex formulas. It has vulnerabilities, we call them loopholes. We call exploits tax avoidance strategies, and there's an entire industry of black hat hackers intent on finding exploitable loopholes in the tax code. We call them accountants and attorneys. And in the book, A Hacker's Mind, Bruce takes hacking out of the world of computing and uses it to analyze the systems that underpin our society, from tax laws to financial markets to politics. He reveals an array of powerful actors whose hacks bend our economic, political, and legal systems to their advantage at the expense of everyone else. It was great discussing the book with him, and I hope you enjoy the episode. You say early on in the book that hacking is something that the rich and powerful do. How does this reinforce existing power structures, would you say?
So it's interesting because I didn't really think of power when I started writing, but it's clear that hacking is a tool of the powerful that reinforces existing power structures. Maybe think about how we normally think of computer hacking. We think of a teenager in a hoodie who's countercultural, hacking the man, hacking the phone network, the computer companies. But really, the best hackers on the planet are the NSA, the Chinese, the Russians, North Koreans, the governments. And when I think of hacking as subverting more social systems, right, the tax code, regulations, financial laws, it is the rich and powerful that are, one, not only better at creating new hacks, and two, have more money to be able to make in these hacks. They are, three, better able to make sure their hacks stay legal and are not closed by whatever the authorities are. And that to me is really interesting. That, yes, I mean, there are examples in the book of marginal communities or, you know, people under oppression, hacking systems, and there are examples of that through history. But the really good hacks take money and then become normalized. So whether it's high frequency trading or Uber subverting all the regulations that protect workers, these are subversions of systems that have now become normal. And that's very much a power thing. So it is an interesting conclusion in the book that I didn't expect, that hacking reinforces power structures. And if you or I discovered a tax loophole, we can use it. We can make a little bit of money, not a lot, and it's likely to be, you know, closed by the government. But when a billionaire finds a loophole, they can make a lot of money, and then they use their lobbying power to make sure they can still do it. In the U.S., we have all sorts of examples of that in our tax code. Hacks, loopholes that we've been trying to close for 20 years, but we can't because of money in politics.
So what would you say, Bruce, is the difference between hacking and cheating?
So I make a very important distinction. So cheating is breaking the rules. Hacking is subverting the rules. It's finding a loophole in the rules. So for example, on my taxes, if I don't declare my income, I'm cheating. Right? I'm lying to the tax authorities. But if I find a trick that allows me to take a deduction that's kind of weird, but the rules allow it, right? It was a loophole in the rules. That's a hack, right? Hacks follow the rules, but subvert the intent. So let me give you an example from sports. It's my favorite example in the book. So in the 1970s, a team shows up on the Formula One racetrack with a six-wheeled car. And everyone says, you can't have a six-wheeled car. And they pull up the rule book and say, show me. And it turns out that the rules were silent on the number of wheels a car could have. Because who thought that a car has anything other than four wheels? Right? Nobody thought to write the rule in. So that's a hack. And actually, the way that story goes is a few years later, the Formula One race authority, I don't know who they are, they have a French name, changed the rules. Now, if you read the rule book, a car can have no more than, or no less than, in case you get any ideas, four wheels. So that's a hack. They didn't break the rules. They found a loophole in the rules.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, Bruce, but I got the impression from your book that all before you understand something like hacking, you have to acknowledge that all systems have ambiguity and oversight that can be exploited. Is that a correct assumption or summary for me to have gotten to?
So it is correct. I don't know if it's true. I mean, I don't have a mathematical proof of it, but I have an intuition that all systems of rules are incomplete or inconsistent. Right? There are things they left out, like the number of wheels on the car. I mean, they left it out because everyone knew it. Or maybe a change in technology happens and, the rules suddenly don't cover all situations. So I think as long as there's a closed set of rules, there is going to be hacking. So I have another example from cricket. So a few years ago, a cricket player, I forget the name, his name's in the book, realized that you can hit the ball behind you. Now, it's a way of hitting a cricket ball that no one had thought of for the past, what, 100 years of cricket. The rules didn't prohibit it, but no one thought of it. That's a hack.
In the book, you go through the different kinds of hacks there are, and you have the chapter titled Societal Hacks Are Often Normalized, which you mentioned already, actually. So, how would you say does this tend to come about?
So it's just interesting. So let's take the cricket example. When someone invents a way to hit the ball that no one thought of before, and then the game has two options. The game can say, wait, that's not okay, right? Like the six-wheeled car. We're going to change the rules to make sure you don't do that again. Or they say, whoa, this is kind of neat. This is exciting. It makes the game better. We're going to allow it. What happens is the authority in charge of the rules gets to decide. Now, in sports, that's easy. There is some actual authority in charge of the rules. If it's a computer, that's easy. The company that makes the software, Microsoft or Google or Apple, gets to decide, do we patch the system or do we let this happen? For things like regulatory loopholes, for tax loopholes, it's harder because there's a government. It's legislators. It's a process. Some people like it, some people don't. So if there's a loophole, I mean, I'll give an American example. Peter Thiel, a billionaire here, found a loophole in something called the Roth IRA, and that's a retirement vehicle that's meant for middle-class taxpayers when it was created. And he figured out a way that he could shield $5 billion with a B from tax forever. That clearly hacked the system, not the intention of anybody who wrote that law. Now, it seems like that's going to be allowed. That no one can come in and say, hey, you've broken the rules because you kind of didn't. Or you can rewrite the rules to retroactively make that not allowed, but that's not going to happen. A lot of times the courts decide. You and I have a set of rules that we're working under, and I find something that's kind of a loophole in the rules, and I do it, and you say, hey, you shouldn't be able to do that. I say, yes, I can. Here's the rules. Well, you all go to court, and you argue, and I argue in front of a judge, and a judge decides whether the hack is legal. And we saw a lot of that in the early days of the internet, when companies were finding loopholes in all sorts of regulations and rules and systems because no one thought of the internet. And some of them were allowed, some of them, like Napster, was not allowed. So there is a process, there's an evolutionary process. Because hacking isn't necessarily bad, right? Hacking is innovation. Some of these changes are really good, like the new way of hitting a cricket ball. Some of them we think are bad, like the six-wheeled car. But one of the most fun things about the book is I have examples from all over, from religion, from history, from sports. A lot from finance and government and taxes, but I love pulling examples from all over.
This also goes as far as to undermining regulations as well. And so, how do big companies try to exploit this as well in terms of hacking?
So to me, what happens is a big company or a financial company, like a Goldman Sachs, a Morgan Stanley, looks for hacks, right? A new tax law is published in the US, in the UK, somewhere else, and there are some tax attorneys who pore over the letters of that law, looking for hacks, looking for loopholes. And if they find them, they sell them to their wealthy customers. And there are weird ones through history of like you can buy an airplane and lease it out, and there's weird things you can do with deductions and depreciations, right? This is not a loophole that's available to you and I, right? You have to be the kind of person who can buy an airplane, and not a little one, like a big commercial airplane. And then they are used. They become these tax dodges. They become these regulatory dodges. Or you are Uber, and you figure out that, look, you don't have to classify your drivers as employees. So this is very much an American example. I actually don't know what it's like in the UK or the EU, but in the United
It was
States,
happening here as well, Bruce. Same, yeah.
right? And it allows Uber to bypass all of these employment laws, because their argument is, well, these are not our employees. They're taking advantage of a loophole. Now, we have been trying in the US to patch that, right? California did have a bill to classify Uber workers and all these gig workers as employees of all the companies. It was lobbied extensively. The amount of money that was poured into making sure that bill didn't pass was enormous. And it didn't pass. And so here's the company spending a lot of money making sure that that loophole stays.
I don't know whether it was within the same chapter, but you made a very, very good point about how in Nairobi, almost in response to the hack, the customers will hail the Uber, and then the Uber driver will agree with the customer to cancel the booking, and then they'll pay the Uber driver directly instead, which is almost like a hack within a hack.
Right, so this is interesting. So this is a hack, right? This is a hack by the powerless. I mean, they're fine. Their wages are being cut. The Uber's taking a huge commission. They're not making money, so they use the Uber system to get the rider, and then the rider and driver agree to go off app. Now, that's interesting because if you think about it, Uber's going to figure that out. I mean, if you as a driver have 8 to 10 rides canceled a day, they're gonna know you're doing this. Right? So they can shut you off the system. And I don't know enough about the Nairobi system. I couldn't find anybody to talk to who knew about it. I was looking and I never got the answer to this. Like, why doesn't Uber shut that down? They know who it is. They know which riders, they know which drivers, because they have the data. But right, that is a way that people have fought back. There are tricks that are done in several countries where the ride you get, usually for delivery services, depends on where you are. So you'll hang your phone in a tree near the warehouse, so it seems like you're closer. So you'll get the job, right? Yeah, so there are definitely these tricks that gig workers and a variety of businesses have come up with. I mean, originally, riding for Uber and Lyft at the same time was a hack. It's been normalized. But in the early days, if either of those ride-sharing systems figured out you were driving for both, they would cut you out of the system. Then they realized that everybody is driving for both, and they can't do that. But that was a hack, and that's a hack that's been normalized. So here are some examples of hacks from the bottom that try to subvert the power structure.
And just moving on from that, Bruce, I also want to ask you, how do the rich and powerful use luxury real estate as a hack?
All right, so you're in London, and London is like ground zero for this. And it turns out that in cities like London and New York, and I believe Miami, and possibly others, that real estate transactions are exempt from a lot of the financial regulations that other types of investments are. So know your customer, anti-money laundering, all of those things that you'd have to do if you were buying and selling commodities don't apply to real estate, which basically means luxury real estate is tailor-made for money laundering. If you are a Russian oligarch, you can't invest your money any other way. You have to buy real estate in Belgravia, right? You have no choice. And so then you can take that real estate, you put all your money in it, now you can borrow against it. And that's clean money that you can do whatever you want with. Now, this is definitely a hack, right? Because of that regulatory arbitrage that the oligarchs are playing. And of course, the result is that, you know, in your city, there's a lot of neighborhoods that aren't anybody living in them because they're basically just vehicles for money laundering. Now, we can close this loophole, right? We can demand the same financial disclosure rules for real estate that we do for every other financial transaction. But the cities don't want it. The cities like the fact that they're getting these huge amount of tax dollars based on these inflated real estate prices. So it is a hack that has stayed around, but yeah, that is totally money laundering.
When does being too big to fail also become a hack?
So I think it is a hack. It's a hack against the market system. So if you think about the way that the market's supposed to work, that I'm a company, I make decisions of what to sell, what prices, what features, all those things. If I make good decisions, I get rewarded. If I make bad decisions, I get penalized. Good companies succeed, bad companies fail. It's this Darwinian marketplace, survival of the fittest. And we believe that that gives us the best stuff at the lowest prices. That is our belief. So if you are too big to fail, which is a thing in the United States, I don't know if it is in the UK, where companies are so large and their failure is so catastrophic for the economy and the country in general that the government will bail them out. So if you are a company that's too big to fail, basically, if you make good decisions, you succeed and do well. If you make bad decisions, it doesn't cost you anything because the government protects you. And we saw that in the financial crisis in 2008. Companies that made really bad decisions didn't have to pay the cost of those decisions. Now, that affects your decision-making process. If you know that if you take risks and if you win, you get the benefit, if you lose, you don't pay the price, you're going to take bigger risks because it's not really risky to you. It's risky to everybody. It's privatized gains, socialized losses, which is the worst. And to me, that is the hack. I mean, too big to fail really means too big to exist because it subverts our systems so thoroughly.
And as you said in the book, you know, it gets to the point where the government will save more money by bailing them out than allowing these companies to fall apart.
Right, and that's the fundamental problem, that it's actually in the government's interest to bail them out. So the way to solve this is you got to get to the companies before they're too big to fail and make sure they don't get that big. And that's antitrust, anti-monopoly, I mean, all of those things that we should do more of and we don't.
If you don't mind touching on the chapter venture capital and private equity, how do companies such as Uber and WeWork benefit from venture capitalism as a hack?
So to me, again, this is a hack of the basic market, right? You know, that you make decisions and the market rewards or penalizes you depending on your decisions. What VC funding does, it's a separate injection of money that's not in that process. So it allows companies to make bad decisions and still survive, not be profitable, but survive. And it means they can do things that are counter to the market. And so Uber is losing something like 40 cents on the dollar, every dollar, still. And, you know, their idea is we're going to destroy the taxi industry and then we'll raise our prices. Or we'll wait for driverless cars and we'll fire all our employees. And they're able to do it because they have this injection of funding from other sources. So VC funding very much perturbs this supply and demand, sellers competing for buyers market by allowing companies to make decisions that would make no sense otherwise. And to me, that is a hack. That is a hack of the fundamental market economics.
Absolutely. When you mentioned, I think it might have been Uber Eats, or it was just some sort of food delivery service, and how all across the board, it does nobody any favors.
Oh yeah, it's terrible. Like, nobody makes money, nobody's happy. It's just awful.
It's true. However, in the spirit of capitalism, what you usually expect is for these systems, which aren't the greatest and which doesn't benefit anyone, to essentially fail. But venture capitalism allows them to stay alive, which is essentially a hack in itself.
I think that's right. All right. I will got one last hack for you. This is not in the book. I learned about it more recently. This is a hack of religion. Okay, of Christianity. So here's the hack. You want to commit suicide, but suicide is a mortal sin. If you commit suicide, you go straight to hell. That's the problem. So here's the hack. You commit murder. You kill an innocent person. You're going to be executed, which is what you want. But before you're executed, you can confess to a priest and you don't go to hell. Okay, so this is not a joke. This was actually a problem in Europe in like the 17th and 18th centuries, Northern Europe, particularly Denmark for some reason, that people were doing this. They were committing murders in order to get themselves killed without going straight to hell. And the only way they patched this, the only way they solved this, was eliminating capital punishment. How's that for a crazy hack?
Yeah, where do you even go from there? I didn't know that one, you know?
No.
Wow. So, another one I want to talk to you about, Bruce, is hacking political systems. How does money in politics also become a hack, would you say?
So it definitely becomes a hack in the United States, where, you know, money in politics has really subverted our process. That, you know, we just do not really have elections where majority wins. It's like it's where money wins. And that's a subversion of the democratic ideal that, you know, one person, one vote, what the majority wants, the majority gets, those sorts of ideals. Money in politics subverts that. It changes that. It means money is more important than support because of the weird ways the U.S. system works. And lots of reasons why this is so. I mean, I don't want to go into them here, but, you know, the U.S. is particularly complicated because we have extraordinarily long election cycles is one of the reasons. I mean, you in the U.K., you call an election, you're done in a month. It's great. Ours lasts 2 years. And it's insane. And our country's way bigger, and television matters way more. You know, a lot of things make money much more important in this country than in I think, any other country. And that means that there is this need for money that overrides the need for votes. I mean, you need votes, but you need money first.
Absolutely. And I feel as though the book has come at the perfect time because of the widespread coverage of ChatGPT and AI. So, but regarding cognitive hacks, Bruce, will AI be able to hack our minds?
So this is a little stretch here of my analogy, right? Because these are not systems that are designed for a purpose. These are evolved systems. But we can think about, you know, what the original use of these systems are when we were living in small family groups in the East African highlands, 100,000 BC. You know, we evolved in a particular time and place for particular ways of living. And our brains, our bodies reflect that. You know, the amount of time we spend in civilization is the blink of an eye in evolutionary terms. So I look at a lot of these subversions of our cognitive systems, our systems of trust, of fear, of attention, of tribalism, of authority, as hacks. And Facebook hacks our attention. Terrorism hacks fear. And I think that is a pretty strong way of looking at it, right? The systems are being abused in a way they were not intended. Where intended is not the right word, right? Because there's no intent here. But I think my analogy is good.
And what hacks will AI potentially find, and how can we defend against them, Bruce?
So this is how I end my book. And I think it's a really important thing to think about. that I'm describing this process of hacking, right? Finding loopholes. So figuring out how to subvert taxi regulations, or finding a new tax loophole, or figuring out how to use luxury real estate to get around know your customer and anti-money laundering. Humans discovered these, right? Human ingenuity looked at the rules and said, hey, it never says you can't have a six-wheeled car. Let's give it a try, see what happens. And that's something that an AI could do. Right, that an AI, you could imagine feeding an AI all the tax laws and say, find ways that I haven't thought of yet to save money on taxes. Right, the U.S. tax law, EU tax law, whatever, the world's tax laws. And because this kind of pattern matching is something AIs can do, I expect that this will happen. That AIs will, in the future, be the ones that are finding these loopholes. Now, of course, at that point, I mean, I'm imagining there's an AI in the basement of Goldman Sachs. It chugs along on the tax laws. It finds loopholes, shows it to people, and the people say, yeah, this one's terrible. This one's, oh, wait, here's a good one. I mean, it's going to be a computer-human team together. And eventually they turn into tax avoidance products that Goldman sells. But this really does feel like something that's going to happen in the near future.
Lastly, Bruce, what is a takeaway, not the takeaway, but a takeaway you'd like the reader or listener to get from this book?
I think it's what you started with, that power matters. That this is not hacking by the poor, by the marginalized, by the people who are not the dominant racial, social, ethnic group. These are hacking by the rich and powerful. They are better at hacking, and they use hacks to further entrench their wealth and power. And that's the way to think of it. And I think that's the surprise to me. And, you know, in retrospect, why should I have been surprised? But that was the surprise to me. And I think that's the important thing to take away. That we need, as society, we need to notice these hacks and do our best to close them, because they are not working in our favor.
That was Bruce Schneier, author of the book A Hacker's Mind, How the Powerful Bend Society's Rules and How to Bend Them Back. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Bruce for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next one.